Welcome to The Armchair Directors, where each episode we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week we are going back to the great Alfred Hitchcock, this time focusing on his 1958 classic Vertigo. Originally receiving mixed reviews, it was recently ranked by Sight and Sound magazine as the greatest film ever made.
Vertigo, a feeling of dizziness, a swimming in the head. Figuratively, a state in which all things seem to be engulfed in a whirlpool of terror, as created by Alfred Hitchcock in the story that gives new meaning to the word suspense.
Returning on the show to talk about Vertigo is Professor Marie Westhaver. Professor Westhaver, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, what is your overall opinion of this film? This is my third or fourth time seeing this, and I definitely agree with it's one of his best. I don't think it's his best. I don't necessarily think it's the best film ever made, but I do think it's very good.
I think it's a good Hitchcock film because it's very revealing about Hitchcock himself. But it has some problems. I mean, when you watch it now, there are some things that I always have to explain to my students. For one thing, in 1958, there was no 911. So when Jimmy Stewart's character fishes Madeline out of the water, he puts her in his car, takes her to his house, takes off all of her clothes, and puts her in his bed. Now, nobody would do that today. I mean, even if you didn't have 911, I think you could still find a phone and call an ambulance. Mm-hmm. So that is a very strange plot development. Also, it's not clear whether she's pretending the whole time. It appears that she just wakes up naked in his bed. And that's just such a strange way to, you know, try to meet somebody and start dating them. There's also a really strange sequence that comes after that where you see her underwear in the bathroom hanging up to dry. And there's these ginormous granny panties and the slip. And it all looks like somebody's mother's underwear, which undercuts the whole sexiness of it and makes it really strange to watch in this day and age. Although I'm sure in 1958 it was hot stuff.
You know, one thing I was always wondering, it's just they never got to the past. It's like, you know, if I was the private investigator, if I was Jamie Stewart, I would just say, look, just take her to a therapist or something. It's this more sensible way to do than have me trail her around everywhere.
Well, not to mention, if you've been hired to follow somebody and they actually try to commit suicide and you fish their limp body out of the water, even if you're not going to call an ambulance, you would think you would call the woman's husband.
Yeah.
I've got your wife. She's naked in my bed. You know, maybe you should come see if she has had a concussion or something. No effort is made to make sure that she's physically all right, which would just never happen in a film today. Even with the suspension of disbelief, it feels wrong. It makes the character that Jimmy Stewart plays seem even creepier.
Definitely. So I take it you don't agree with the recent poll that it's the greatest film ever made?
I don't think it's the greatest film ever made. It's a good film, though. It has a lot of interesting things going on in it.
So tell us a little about the backstory behind making this film. Like, what was what inspired Hitchcock to make this? Because I know it was based off a book which I've actually read. It was called The Living and the Dead, French novel.
The interesting thing about the story is that Hitchcock wanted to set a film in San Francisco for a long time. And he had a lot of trouble getting the permission from the city, and then he finally did that. And then he had to postpone because he had gallbladder surgery. And then he had to postpone again because Vera Miles, who was supposed to be the Kim Novak character, got pregnant, which he never forgave her for. So he ended up having to use Kim Novak instead. But if you look at the picture of Carlotta, the painting that's in the museum, it's actually a painting that was made of Vera Miles because they thought she was going to be the character.
Yeah, I remember we discussed this in The Psycho, and I know when I was watching that film, I was like, all right, let me see if that looks like Vera Miles.
And it does.
It does, yeah. So I was wondering, have you had a chance to read the novel?
I have not read the novel. I, of course, have heard of the novel, but no, I have not read it.
Yeah, I've read it. It's a good, it's a pretty, as far as adaptations go, it's pretty faithful. They change it around a bit because it's in France. And it's before and after the occupation in World War II. So that's, but I do recommend it. It's a very good read.
Now, Hitchcock previously tried to buy the rights to the same author's previous novel, Celle qui n'était plus, but he wasn't able to do that. But that was made into Les Diaboliques, which would have been a really cool Hitchcock film, I think.
Yeah, very Hitchcockian. So, you know, one thing that always stuck out to me when I'm watching this film is the two primary colors in the film, red and green. And so I always kind of was wondering what the red and green represent. To me, the green represents sort of the dreamlike, because, you know, when he's having her dress up as Madeline, and we see her for the first time dressed as Madeline again, and it's sort of through this green haze. So I think green is sort of like the dream state, the reality, what he wants things to be. So I was wondering what your opinion is on the heavy use of green and red in the film.
It's more of a theme of the character. The first time you see Kim Novak's character, actually both times when you see Madeline and Judy, the first time you see them, they're wearing green. And she does step out of like a dreamlike sequence. It almost, you know, it's actually one of the nicest shots in the film where she's coming out of the bathroom and she's dressed up as the other woman. It is sort of a dreamlike effect. She also has a green car. And Scotty's jumper is green, and there's a green light that Judy appears in. I think that also has to do with go. And the red represents stop in a way. You know, stop and look. Stop and look in Ernie's restaurant at her in, you know, against the red and the dressing gown that Madeline wears. Stop, look, think. Mm-hmm. There's something going on here.
So what are some other themes you see in the movie? Because one thing one thing that really stuck out is the theme of obsession and control. You know, once James Stewart sees Madeline again, he wants to see her again, and she can't just see it as this other person. He forces her to dress up exactly like her and have her hair dyed the same and have it curled up in the same bun. So that's one of the what other themes do you see in the movie?
I think what you've touched on is the main theme, and that is that it's a very personal story because Hitchcock was always dressing his leading ladies. This is one of the movies that Edith Head did all of the costumes for. And Edith Head was oftentimes tasked by Hitchcock to dress his ladies on screen and off screen, famously with Tippi Hedren, mm-hmm. giving her an entire wardrobe to wear, both for her roles and also for when she went to Hollywood premieres and when she was just picking up groceries. He redid her completely. So it's a very personal look at how Hitchcock kind of saw women as objects to be manipulated mm-hmm. to his specifications and liking, even though it's very clear that the character and the real people really weren't that comfortable with it.
Sounds like he was a little bit self-critical.
You know, the interesting, there's a great quote I heard from Hitchcock about in terms of being self-critical, that in his head, he carried around an image of himself, of what he looked like. And he was always surprised when he would come across a reflection and see what he really looked like, because in his mind, he thought he looked like Cary Grant.
Yeah, remember that. So one other thing I really like about this film is the opening title sequence, which was done by Saul Bass. Yes, and Saul Bass did almost all the Hitchcock films in the 50s. So I really like that opening title sequence, and I think it really sets the tone for the very creepy and disturbing atmosphere of the movie.
It does also have that Bernard Herrmann score, which gives it that deliberately that sense of unease, because it's discordant. It immediately makes you uneasy and makes you feel uncomfortable, which goes with the feeling of having vertigo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have to talk about that score by Bernard Herrmann because, you know, even if you don't think that this is the best movie ever made, I think the score is what makes people think this is one of the best films of all time. It's just a really incredible score. Just throughout the film, it's got the really soft string romantic music. And it's got the heavy percussion when he's having the disturbing dream sequence. I just think the music in this film is Herrmann's best, and it's just incredible.
I agree. I think it's one of Herrmann's best as well, and very evocative of the mood it's trying to create. In terms of themes, though, it also has Hitchcock's mother theme in there when Midge says to Scotty, "You're not lost. Mother is here." And mm-hmm. setting up that Barbara Bel Geddes character as not the romantic lead, but, you know, the girl next door, and also... Mm-hmm. The things that he doesn't like about her is because, you know, she's very motherly. Mm-hmm. It also, of course, is a voyeuristic movie because he's, you know, stalking this woman and following her everywhere and, you know, spying on her when she doesn't know that, well, she really does know that he's watching, but he thinks that he is spying on her.
Yeah, it does seem that Barbara Bel Geddes' character is, you know, the one that you feel he should end up with because she's the better person or something. But, you know, he's too obsessed over Madeline, so that's the one he has to be with almost.
You know, what's really interesting about the Barbara Bel Geddes' character is in Alfred Hitchcock Presents, he did an episode called Lamb to the Slaughter. And it is about a woman played by Barbara Bel Geddes who is married to a cop. And he's cheating on her, and he comes home and tells her it's over. She's pregnant. You know, you can keep the baby, but we're done. And she says, you can't possibly. You know, I love you. And she goes to get a frozen leg of lamb and whacks him over the head with it and kills him. And then, of course, there's this whole proceeding. You know, all of his friends are, his cop friends are, you know, looking over the body. And, you know, they're kind of figuring, well, you know, did she know that he was running around on her? And, you know, what could have done that? You know, was there a, you know, a billy club or a shillelagh or a, you know, bowling pin or something? And they're looking for the murder weapon, and she cooks the leg of lamb and feeds it to them, so they eat it. They eat the evidence.
Oh my God!
It's a wonderful tongue-in-cheek Hitchcock Presents episode. But the interesting thing about it with Vertigo is it's almost like what could have happened. You know, if he ended up with the Barbara Bel Geddes character, the cop who really didn't want to be married to her, you know. Sometimes it ends like Vertigo, where you fall off the building, and sometimes somebody hits you with a leg of lamb.
Now, there's one interesting theory I read on the internet. I know you can't take too much stock of what's written on the internet, but I found this was interesting. Somebody theorized that the whole story is in James Stewart's head, and he's still hanging on that ledge in the beginning of the film.
No, I haven't heard that before, but that would work. You could make that work.
Yeah, because I think one thing is like, well, if the cop fell to his death, how was he able to pull himself up and get across the rooftop?
They never show him being rescued either.
Yeah.
Which in today's movie, you would kind of have to show that part. Yeah. There would be some cool special effects that you could use. But, you know, he's hanging there and the gutter is breaking. And then the next scene, he's fine.
Yeah, he's fine. So maybe there is some stock to it, you know?
I hadn't considered it, but, you know, it could be.
So, you know, I when we usually think of James Stewart, I think, we think of, like, you know, It's a Wonderful Life and the other Capra films. And they're, you know, he sort of was cast early in his career as the all-American good guy. I think with this film, he really changes that. He's very disturbing. He's controlling. He's obsessed.
He's creepy.
He's creepy. Yeah, very creepy, like you said. So, you know, I really think that this was one of his best performances because it's really against type for him.
It is against type for him. Another thing that I think doesn't work as well as it did in 1958 is that he does look considerably older. And Kim Novak, who was in her 20s, also looks older because she's got very, very pale hair and she's dressed very, very conservatively. I mean, they look like a much older couple than they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, Kim Novak, I'm not familiar. The only other film of hers I've seen was The Man with the Golden Arm with Frank Sinatra. So was this, like, the film that really helped launch her career?
This is what she's most famous for, but she also did Bell, Book, and Candle, which was a pretty big hit for her.
So I'm not that familiar with her career. So, like, I know she kind of did movies somewhat sporadically later in her career, and she retired pretty early. So, like, what was her career after Vertigo?
I think once she did Vertigo, people saw her as that character. I think she had a hard time getting past that.
Mm-hmm.
Even in Bell, Book, and Candle, it's kind of the same sort of really sexy, mysterious, and in that movie, she's a witch.
So, and what other performances in the film stick out to you? I know we talked a little bit about Barbara Bel Geddes. So, you know, her and what any other performances in the film that stand out?
It's really a story about Jimmy Stewart's character and the two women that are played by Kim Novak. Barbara Bel Geddes has a small role, and then all of the others are really small roles. The husband. There is, by the way, if you get the DVD, you can see the ending that they did for Europe, where it ends with a phone call. And that's when they find out that Madeline's husband has been arrested for the crime. So they tie that up neatly. And it's just Scotty and Midge, sitting there, not talking to each other, getting that news. And it's sobering because you see that they're together, but you know neither one of them's happy. She knows how he really feels, and he is...
sort of out of it.
Yeah, sort of done.
It does sound interesting because it does seem like, you know, you have to have in that time you had to have the bad guy get what's coming to him.
Right.
Now, it's surprising in this film, you know, it's sort of left up in the air.
Yeah, unless you watch the European opening version, which is surprising because the Americans are the ones who had the production code where every murderer had to pay for their crime kind of thing.
So, you know, you were talking about this before we started recording. A lot of the, you know, all this film was shot on location in San Francisco. And remember in film class, some people say, like, people actually trek out, map out the journey and take the journey that was taken in the film. So they fall. It's like, you know, when I start following her, they go to the restaurant, and they even go to the Redwoods. So I was wondering, when you've been to San Francisco, do you scout out these locations?
I came across it by accident, but I knew exactly where I was when it happened. The thing to note when you watch the sequence of Jimmy Stewart following Kim Novak's character in the car is it's like a silent sequence. It kind of harks back to his skill as a silent director because there's just the music going on and you're in his head, you're in his car, and you're following this woman. And it goes on for quite a long time. He holds that moment for a really long time. I think that's why people remember that so much. And when they go to San Francisco, they remember it so much because it is an unusual way to shoot the scene. There's no chase scene. There's no, oh, I almost lost her. Oh, there she is down that alley that you're used to with somebody following somebody else.
Yeah, if you come to think of it, I mean, that's maybe a little bit off topic, but you know, people say, oh, New York is the big city where movies are always shot. San Francisco's had a lot of movies shot. You've had this, you've had Bullet, Dirty Harry, Zodiac. So you had a few films shot there.
Well, I can tell you, if you get in a San Francisco cab, you'll remember Bullet big time.
Yeah.
Because I think they all use it for training purposes.
And, you know, I also really like the camera work in this film. And, you know, this film is created with the vertigo effect, which it's dolly in and zoom out.
That's right.
Yeah.
Which is very famous now, and so are the stairs, you know, the repeated use of the stairs, which is one of Hitchcock's motifs. Whenever you see stairs and you see people like looking down the flight of stairs that sort of curl in on themselves, it always reminds people of vertigo.
And, you know, another one I really liked about this film is the animated sequence when he's, you know, he's in the mental hospital and he's having sort of the breakdown. You know, I thought that animated sequence was really good. Do you know who did that?
I do. Contemporary artist John Farron designed this dream sequence in Vertigo. Also, he did the paintings John Forsythe, the character, painted in The Trouble with Harry. So he's worked with Hitchcock a couple of times. And he also gave John Forsythe some tips on technique. So he did that sequence in Vertigo, which is really kind of, that seems very contemporary because it suddenly goes into animation and, you know, a flower breaking apart and Jimmy Stewart's head suspended in midair with the, you know, the swirls going on behind him. And there's also, that takes advantage of the theme of circles and spirals circling back to the same moment again and again. The music is also built around circles and spirals and fulfillment and despair. So all of those things kind of work together to give you that sense of disorientation.
Yeah, when you think about it, you know, unless it was like a Disney movie, you didn't really have like live action movies use animated sequences. So that was pretty groundbreaking at that time.
Another thing to point out is that stuntwoman Polly Burson, who falls from the tower in place of Kim Novak, she had to do a number of jumps from nearly 60 feet into a circus net.
Ooh.
She did it in 3 takes.
Oh.
Strapped to a device that spun her in all different directions while she threw her arms about as if she was falling.
Did she hurt herself anyway?
No, she was a pro.
Wow.
Just get up and do it again.
You know, we were talking about this earlier, but, you know, this film is really interesting with the change in critical reception. When it first came out, it received, it's all right views. Then over time, it's been regarded as a classic. And, you know, like we said, it was just recently ranked by Sight and Sound magazine as the greatest film ever made. But even now, like you've been talking about, the past few years, people are like, oh, it's not that great. It's okay, but it's not that great. So it's just interesting. Great, maybe not that great.
For the movie that it's trying to be about a fatal woman who possesses you utterly, it's very successful. That's not a story that gets told a lot of times, so that's not going to make it on people's best of lists because it's not a common theme. But Hitchcock does it in a very Hitchcockian way. And reveals the director very much.
Yes. And, you know, it was interesting. This film also had an interesting release history because I understand it was removed from circulation for almost a decade along with, I think, Rope and another movie?
Rear Window.
Rear Window. Oh.
Yeah, and they all came back together. I think that had to do with the estate.
Did you think that had any play into the change in critical reception? Maybe people hadn't seen it in a long time and they forgot it?
Or people who never saw it had a chance to see it with new eyes. Mm-hmm. And having seen other Hitchcock films, kind of put it in perspective of his other movies. Because he really did take some risks with showing things about people that are not likable. When I show it in class, after it's over, everybody seems kind of stunned. You know, they're sort of taken aback that it's so dark. Even though you sort of see what's coming, it's just so dark. And I just remember one student at the end just saying, oh, that was really disturbing. And it just leaves you with this sense of unease. Where when it first came out in 58, people probably thought, I feel uneasy, therefore the movie's no good. Or today you might say, I feel uneasy and I'm not. That doesn't happen very often, you know, because I usually see the plot points or, you know, decided to deal with the character in this way. But it leaves you with a weird feeling, and I think that's why it's great.
Yeah, and that last shot in the movie after she falls to her death and there's the bell ringing, you just have Stewart looking there, and he's just complete, like, not again, and he just looks completely out of it.
And he did it to himself.
So, you know, this film is definitely very influential. So I wonder, what films have you seen that have been heavily influenced by Vertigo? I mean, just off the top of my head, you know, a lot of people talk about Brian De Palma's movies, that they're very Hitchcockian and probably have some themes in Vertigo. I don't know if you've seen Terry Gilliam's 12 Monkeys.
Yes.
And there's one sequence where it's very an ode to Vertigo. And have you seen Run, Lola, Run?
Yes, I use that in my World Cinema class.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, in fact, there is a painting of Kim Novak in the scene in the casino. There was a space on the wall, and Tom Tykwer didn't like that space, so he actually had a painting commissioned. And since he was using spirals and several homages to Vertigo and the movie, he had a painting done of Kim Novak from behind, so you see the swirl in his chignon.
Okay.
One of the, my favorite example, though, is from Rango.
Oh, yeah.
There's the point in the movie where Rango is walking through the desert, and he comes across the Clint Eastwood character and says, are we in heaven? And the Clint Eastwood character says, no, if we were in heaven, we would be eating Pop-Tarts with Kim Novak. And then, of course, there's the wonderful High Anxiety,
where
Mel Brooks sends up most of Hitchcock's well-known movies, including Vertigo.
And so I was wondering, of modern filmmakers today, people have been, you know, big in the last, say, decade or so. Are there any of them that you see that is very similar to Hitchcock or very Hitchcockian?
I think a lot of people try to do what Hitchcock did, but they're not comfortable with just making it suspense. They want to make it more of a thriller that involves a lot of guts. I think the name of the movie was Dystopia.
Disturbia with Shia LaBeouf.
Yeah, yeah. Disturbia. Not a really good movie. You would think you could do a lot with that whole idea of Rear Window, where you're spying on people, you see something you shouldn't have seen. But it doesn't have that sense that the Rear Window does, where you feel like you're watching something and it's suspenseful. Instead, you're just waiting for somebody to get whacked.
Yeah. Blood and guts.
Yeah, blood and guts, which sort of ruins the elegance of setting up a really cerebral story. It's hard to be cerebral today because people want the blood and guts.
Yeah,
they want to see the guy falling off the roof.
Yeah, that movie I think is definitely aimed more towards teenagers because that movie came out when I was in middle school, and so a lot of people are like, man, that Disturbia movie was really cool, and you know, I was like, it's not that great.
There's a movie, I believe it's called What Lies Beneath, and it's about somebody spying on their neighbors too, and it does have some Hitchcock-esque Bernard Herrmann music. It's but it's not Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're getting about to the end of my list here. So is there anything else that we haven't talked about Vertigo today that you want to include?
Well, it was shot in VistaVision, so it does have an interesting look to it. And the theme of appearance over reality is something that Hitchcock always liked to play with. And I think probably in this movie, he does the best job of getting across that idea.
Okay. And so then last question I'll ask you is just tell us a little bit about the classes you teach. I mean, I know you've talked about this before, but for those who haven't heard you yet, tell us about the Hitchcock class you teach here.
I just finished teaching Hitchcock in fall of 2015, so I will probably end up offering it again in fall of 2017. That's a class that we offer intermittently. Every semester I teach Intro to World Cinema and Intro to American Cinema, and then in alternate semesters I will teach Women in Film and Film and Philosophy and the History of Animated Film. In fall of 2016, I will be teaching French film as well.
Ooh, sounds like you got your hands full.
I do, but it's with film.
Oh, yeah. All right. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been talking about Alfred Hitchcock and his 1958 classic Vertigo. Do you think it's the best film ever made? Watch it and judge for yourself. I am pleased to announce that we will be back on the air in about 2 to 3 weeks, so we will air soon again every Thursday at 9:30 a.m. and Sunday at 2:30 p.m. And you can still listen to us anytime at thearmchairdirectors.podomatic.com. Professor Westhaver, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
It was a pleasure. So until next time, I'm your host, The Armchair Directors, Alex Baker, saying so long, and I will see you next week.